Tonight on Arena, Louise Lowe, Marty Ray and May Fitzgerald on the new stage version of James Joyce's The Dead, and Jonathan Coe on his new novel, The Proof of My Innocence. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Anyone who has been to a new show since they began with Basin back in 2009 will know it's a frequent habit of theirs, they being director Louise Lowe and designer Owen Buss, to bring the audience up close and personal to a drama that plays with the past and the present, the living and the dead. Who better then to take on James Joyce's ghostly short story, The Dead, The Winter's Tale, in which Gabriel and Greta Conroy go to an annual Christmas party hosted by Gabriel's aunts, Julia and Kate, and have their lives forever changed by the singing of an old song, The Lass of Ockram. Marty Ray and Maeve Fitzgerald play Gabriel and Greta Conroy in this new production. I'm delighted that they're in the studio with me this evening alongside director Louise Lowe. How long have you wanted to do The Dead, Louise? I'm guessing it's probably been something on your bucket list for a long time, has it?
It's been a few years, I think. Yeah, I think that we had talked to Landmark about what kind of work we might like to make together ages ago, like years, maybe 7 years ago.
Yeah, so this is a co-production with yourselves, Landmark,
and Landmark and Molly. Yeah. And then we did Ulysses. We got derailed with other exciting works like Book of Names, and then COVID hit, and then we did Ulysses 2.2. And it was during Ulysses 2.2 and walking through Molly that I flippantly said, God, The Dead would be great in here. I think it was across the Bishop's Room or somewhere. Mm. And yeah, fast forward 7 years.
Yeah, because it's site specific. It could be an usher's key if that particular building wasn't being turned into a set of apartments by somebody in time to come. But when you walked around, it very much is of the period of the piece,
completely.
Molly, and maybe not the room, not the rooms that we see when we go in to visit it as members of the public, which are quite modern.
No.
In behind that, it's a different feel, I'm guessing.
So we're in kind of much older parts of the building in Newman House, which was kind of parts of the university and parts of the college that was there. And I think the evocativeness of the Georgian building, it's much grander than that house would have been, obviously.
Mm.
But it has something in the scale and the feel and the materiality of the wallpaper that just really does stand by itself inside the story, you know, and lends itself very, very easily to the promenade retelling of The Dead.
Yeah, because the audience will follow you around, and will follow Marty and Maeve around, and the other members of the cast as well, as the story unfolds. The Dead itself, Marty, the story, the James Joyce story, did you go back to that? Did you look at the film? You know, how did you approach this when it first came up as an idea?
The story itself. I didn't watch the film again, but I know it kind of well, so I didn't think I needed to, I suppose. But the story, we went back to real kind of with a fine-tooth comb again. And it's such a delicate thing, because it's a massive thing that happens to two people's lives, their marriage. But actually it feels very small or something. So it's massive and small at the same time. That's the tricky thing.
Mm-hmm.
The capture is, it's a small thing between two people, but it's a massive kind of effect.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you put it in that way, because in some ways it's loads of small things that happen here. Yeah. They're at a party.
Yeah.
You know, small things happen, like pieces of food are passed around the table, all of that type of thing. So it very much, there is a big domestic element to it, Maeve, until Greta and Gabriel go off upstairs for a little chat, and then it all just falls apart.
That's right. And many of your listeners will probably know that the story that Greta tells Gabriel is based very closely on a story that Nora Barnacle told James Joyce. As with many of Joyce's works, he took an awful lot of his inspiration from Nora, and he sort of sucked them from her and created the beautiful literature that we have. So that's been really useful, actually, for both of us, in the fact that we have real kind of sources of information to draw from.
Yeah, is it Sonny Bodkin?
Sonny Bodkin, yeah. That's right.
And there was a plaque put up on his grave.
On his grave.
Only recently by Arthur on the Heron, yeah.
Believe it or not, Michael Fury in the story, who is Greta's old suitor, is actually based on two characters. Nora was affectionately, I don't know, known in her convent as the man killer. Because when she was young, two of her suitors died. Sonny Bodkin and Michael Feeney. Michael Feeney was slightly younger than Sonny Bodkin. Michael Feeney was 16 going on 17. So I think that Joyce took his age and youth and he took Bodkin's first name, which was, it was Michael, but they called him Sonny.
Sonny.
And he amalgamated them both into this character of Michael Fury. And also, Joyce was obsessed with Nora's past and kind of insanely jealous, but also strangely titillated by it. So he liked to draw that out of her. And perhaps he put it down on paper as a sort of an attempted exorcism for himself of these jealousies, you know. But that's what we've been exploring, looking at those sort of
sources. Very interesting that, that Maeve points out those real life parallels, Marty. How much of Gabriel Conroy's speech and talk do you think is straight from the mouth of Joyce, as Joyce himself? Is he a mouth? It's a bit simplistic to say a mouthpiece, but is he very much expressing a type, a set of opinions that you think Joyce would be expressing?
I think so. In the same way that Stephen Dedalus is. I think he feels like him to me when you read the stuff that Joyce wrote about himself, because he was, you know, he was very honest in the way that he would write about the inside life of a man, of a young man, especially with Stephen Dedalus. And then in Ulysses, he does it again. In Exiles, the play, how you, that kind of breaks down in a kind of like a, it's like a surgery of what, a surgery on a relationship and how the intensities of a relationship and what different people expect from a relationship itself. It's incredibly honest what Joyce will do. So it must come from a real place. And I think that's the secret to how the humanity of what he writes. We get an awful lot of the sensation of what James Joyce was in his life, his private life, and also the nature of what he produced, you know, Ulysses, Finnegan's Wake, all
that. Yeah, and the fireworks maybe that
exactly
kind of talk about around
the unreachableness of these big pieces of work. But actually the humanity in them is what really strikes me when I take the time and sit down and really dig into them, is that the his understanding of the human condition, I think, is brilliant.
So what you've done then, Louise, in adapting this piece, how, what's on the page and what the actors will be speaking on the night, are they all Joyce's words? Did you have much to add in? Or is it, like, because he writes great dialogue, it has
Absolutely.
To be said, particularly in that story.
And, you know, there was a moment yesterday where there was a bit that just wasn't working. And I was forced to go, the bits that aren't working are your bits. Take them back out. And be really honest about that.
And go, were the actors putting bits? Oh, sorry.
No,
the bits
I'd written in.
Yeah,
and
well,
I was like,
well, that's a big,
you know,
admission.
It hadn't, there was nothing wrong with what he'd given us. And the real trick was actually about pulling it back out. I think the real challenge in this one was taking what is essentially a narrative that's happening inside somebody's head. And that's what the short story gives us beautifully and evocatively. We understand with the minute little calibrations that's going on, the nuance, the, you know, the fearfulness, all those things, the paranoia, all those things that's happening, we get told in beautiful detail in Joyce's words and descriptions. And then the challenge, therefore, is actually to make it theatrical, you know, and then taking that convention and pushing it into a party, a vehicle for a party, whereby you go, how do we all know what those little micro moments are? Because they're brittle and they're, you know, sometimes intangible sometimes. So that's, it was trying to find those bits that could work. And then, as I said, you just got carried away with some of it and went, that bit's not working. Why isn't it working? Because it doesn't need to be there. So it's become more like an editor as we've gone back. It's good to take out a lot of what I'd added in, actually.
So it's predominantly then the words of Joyce himself?
I don't know if it's... Yeah, I think so. Lots of it is really faithful to the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
But I'm guessing
at this stage it is.
Yeah. Sorry, Marty, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I think probably at this stage it is. See, we are a party and a huge section of it is a party. And the audience are going to be in that dinner party as
and
well.
And in the actual story itself, the party, you know, moves from people arriving at the house up the stairs into the various rooms.
Exactly what this experience is too. So the people are going to be, there's going to be, they're going to talk amongst each other as they're moving through. And so there's a lot of, you have to fill that up with ad-libbing as a character in the story that you need to know inside out so that you can do that. I can't suddenly be Gabriel talking to someone about, I don't know, that I'm breeding horses or something now. I can't just make stuff up. So you have to keep within your guidelines, but Yeah, for the most part, for the set pieces of dialogue that we're working with, I think
it's
it
within
is
the bandwidth
it definitely
of the story,
is mostly
I think, yeah.
Joyce. Yeah.
But even the ad-libbed or improvised bits, there's so much stuff in the story that we're sticking really closely to stuff that the characters say or think or do in the story as well. So yeah, there's no crazy departures, so I don't think for any characters.
So you can have internalized thoughts maybe expressed outwardly.
Exactly.
They're internalized thoughts on the page, but on the stage they're spoken outwardly.
I think a great example of that would be the relationship between Freddie and Mrs. Malins, which has been really beautifully pulled apart by Billy Traynor and John Cronin, and I think examined in a really beautiful kind of a way, and what they found their relationship between each other and her worry about her son, who has, you know, problems with alcohol, and his worry about letting her down. That's been teased out really nicely in those kind of improvised moments.
And having a party is such a great way of bringing, then all the characters are together around this table, and a chance for a few songs and entertainments along the way, Louise.
And it's been great fun. It's, do you know what, I told the researcher yesterday, it's probably would have been one of the best fun rehearsals I've ever had, and certainly one of the best companies I've ever worked with. Like, it's been great fun. But I think the challenge has been then to go from that mode of party then into the kind of the quietness of the bedroom. So we've had to work very hard at like breaking the party convention to then become something else, you know, and those in that final scene.
Yeah, there's such intimacy in that in that final scene.
And we started there. Yeah. We worked backwards.
We did.
We started from the bedroom and worked back.
Well, yeah, I guess because the story, the play is ultimately about their relationship, really, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, to figure out that relationship first, and it's such a contrast, and we even find that when we're performing it, don't we? When we're rehearsing it, the busyness of the party, all of a sudden, we're transported directly into the Gresham. The energy is completely different, and I don't want to give away too much, but where you will witness the bedroom scene is really special, I think. It's a really special
place. The part of the building that we're brought to.
I mentioned
the film earlier on. I don't know how big a shadow. I'm guessing Donald McCann's a fairly big shadow, and Jesse Angelica Houston is a fairly big shadow around both of you. Is it useful to even think about that film in any way, Mae?
I've had to really try and banish it from my mind because it's one of my favourite films, and I know it so intimately. And luckily, the process of rehearsal has helped to do that. It is such an iconic film. But at the same time, the story is such an iconic story that everybody has such a personal relationship with the story. So everybody will have their own idea of who Greta, Gabriel, Michael, Fury, Freddie are. All we can do is present our version and hope that it speaks to people in some way. I think everybody has their own version of Michael Fury as well. Be it a place, a time, a memory, a moment. And that's why people relate so much to that story, that moment in your past you long for, you regret, you love. And it's so universal that I hope that any preconceptions that people have of the story will hopefully be gradually shed as the evening goes on, because I think we're doing something new but faithful, if that makes sense.
I'd love to ask all three of you what's the Michael Fury moment in your life, but I will.
Oh, God!
I will desist.
You're here all night, John.
Yeah, and I'd have to probably tell my Michael Fury moment if such a thing existed.
You're my Michael Fury.
the Donald McCann shadow, I know you're doing your play, you're doing this version, Marty, but it must be very hard not to. When I think of that character, I just see his face immediately.
I know, yeah. It is funny, you do. But then it goes back to what you were saying earlier on. In the research for this, I think this goes for Maeve as well. I think I probably read more about Joyce and Nora than I did about the play.
Yeah.
Or the story.
Yeah.
And so Joyce's face is in my head more than Donald McCann's is, strangely.
Yeah,
like,
so
I keep seeing his. Now, maybe it doesn't help in Moley, James Joyce's face is everywhere in the building.
Yes, yeah.
That it might have something to do with it. And James Joyce taught in that building when it was UCD.
Mm.
So he's very
present.
He feels very present all the time. But it just, you know, when you read all the bits of his real life with Nora, and you think you see the parallels in it. Mm. There's a bit in the short story where he talks about looking at a photograph of Gabriel sees a photograph of his mother and his brother, She's sat with a book on her lap, and the brother he's a child, the brother's a child, and he's got a little sailor suit on or something like that. And there's an actual photograph of Joyce with his mother. She's got a book on her lap, and he's got the little sailor suit on. So it's
almost
that is obvious. He's obviously thinking of that photograph.
A direct parallel. Yeah. I'm also wondering, Louise, because I was speaking to you just before we came to air about, I think the last time you were in with us, you were saying, was when we were talking about The Pull of the Stars, which Maeve herself was in as well, and the adaptation of the Emma Donoghue novel, In the Gate. A novel to a play, there's a lot of condensing going on there, but a short story to a play strikes me that it might be not quite the big cull that a novel to a play is.
Well, Emma took her own novel and made it into a play and did all the heavy lifting on that one. But it feels like the year of adaptation in some way, because
The Sean O'Casey
gone from that to Star Jazzer to this. So
The Sean O'Casey story,
for
Star Jazzer.
Theatre Festival. So I really feel like in ways I've never made work by other authors before, that I've just gone into come on into my world, all of you souls. Mm. And it's been a really delicious year for that reason, because you're working with the level of writing from Emma and Sean O'Casey and James Joyce. There's a part of you that just goes, who are you to mess with it? Do you know what I mean? Why? But then when you see it come alive, you go, oh, there's a potency or an alchemy in the room of watching. How lucky am I to get into a room and sit with these guys every day and watch that up close and personal humanity just being pulled apart and your level of detail is extraordinary. Your commitment to each other and the rigour of that watching brings it so much to life. It's amazing.
I was also asking you, Marty, I was remembering Epiphany, a play that Druid did a couple of years back now. I can't remember the exact period that it was done, but it was it was in and around the story of the dead and set on the 6th of January, hence the title Epiphany. And Marie Mullen, who's in this as well, was part of that play.
She was, yeah.
Those things must seep in some ways.
That is definitely seeping in, because Marie played more or less the same character, or a character
It wasn't a stage version of the dead, but certainly there were echoes of the dead all over that play.
Yeah, she played a character called Morkan, and she was giving a dinner party on the Feast of the Epiphany, and we were all invited. So, yeah, every time, and all she talked about in that play was Julia. Julia's not here. Julia's not able to be here. And we were all, well, what's wrong with Julia? And now she's Julia.
She's Julia.
Yeah. So every time, I do think about that play quite a bit.
I can imagine that would be the case. Over the Christmas period, it's perfect Christmas fair. I know there's a kind of a sadness in it, but it is perfect Christmas fair in some ways, Louise.
Absolutely. I think there's a nostalgia inside this work that catches all of us at moments in different ways, because, you were sitting Christmas would go on for a long time in our lives this year.
Yeah.
But we've been sat in it now at a Christmas dinner table for the last 3 or 4
decorations
weeks.
And
the decorations are all up and they're all around it and stuff. And rehearsing on site has been amazing, because we've been there. We're there with the set, with the stuff, with the props, with the texture of everything around us has been amazing. But there's something really, really nostalgic about this story that I think when you get as far as those speeches and you think about who's here and who's not and looking forward, it's always that time of year that we think these things for ourselves, for our families, for our hopes, for our wishes. And it just makes you take stock and stay with it. And it's not typical Christmas story, and yet it's an absolutely typical Christmas story.
You must be praying for snow. at least one of the nights.
Absolutely.
That there'll be a bit.
I'd love it to go when Julie says, I just love snow and it's there.
Nobody'd be able to come to the show, though.
They'd manage. they'd
we thought we'd get a star for Star Jazzer, and even that proved difficult. Can hold out me hope for snow, though, right?
Just finally, in typical Anu fashion, how many people will be at this Christmas, this 6th of January party with the cast? Because it's quite a big cast.
Yeah.
12 or 14?
It's a big party, and it's a big audience for us. It's 75, which is bigger than our normal audiences.
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of challenge. But there was no point in having a party of 10. it would have just felt lonely and a bit strange. So I suppose just giving in to how many people would make a good party and fill those rooms and fill those spaces in a way that feels real, actually. And it's our 50th show. Maeve was in our first one, which was Basin, how many years ago. So it's really nice to come back on a 50th show with a big audience and a big company, a big cast and great project partners.
No,
it's touching everything.
It's very exciting stuff indeed. And I guess that immersive element, the audience essentially in that situation may have, are much, they're more present than an audience in a proscenium arch or in any other type of theatre.
And I love that. I find the big dark space sometimes a bit scary. I love being able to see people's faces, particularly for people if, number one, if they have a close relationship with the story, for them to be next to them while they're experiencing, where they're experiencing it in this way. But also if people have never read the story, to be so close to them when they're experiencing it for the first time, that's such a privilege. And you don't get that kind of privilege when you're on a stage. It's you don't get that immediate reaction. And also we were discussing today how each audience will bring its own energy and how that will affect us, and how that's a really lovely thing to feed off as well.
So you had it in Gatsby, you were part of Gatsby in the Gate, where you had that audience interaction of the same nature in some ways.
The real gift about it is the smallness that we were talking about, the smallness of moments in this. The story is going to be well. We're going to be able to get that very well in when they're sitting that close to you.
Yeah, well, if you start acting, you'll be found out immediately. You just have to do it.
Happened a long time ago.
Listen, thanks to all three of you for coming in. Thank you. And Landmarks Production, in association with Molly Museum of Literature Ireland, presents James Joyce's The Dead, 85 St Stephen's Green, Dublin, from Tuesday, November the 26th. Until Sunday, January the 12th. I wonder who'll be there on January the 6th. That'll be very
That was
exciting.
The first show to sell out.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I believe it's very heavily sold already, is it?
I think so, yeah. Great.
We get on the website immediately. Previews from Friday, November the 22nd. Further details on thedead.ie. And sure, there's only one way I can finish up with the song that sparks the whole thing off. A wonderful version of The Last of Ockham here from Lisa O'Neill.
If you'll be the last of Ockram, as I am taking you to be, come tell me the last token passed between you and me. Oh, don't you remember that night up beyond Lean Hill, where we both met together? I'm sorry now to tell. The rain falls on my heavy locks, and dew soaks my skin. My babe lies cold within my arms, and none will let me in. Oh, the rain falls on my heavy locks, and dew soaks my skin. My babe lies cold within my arms, and none will let me in.
You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Now, you might think there's not much fun to be had these days in the realm of political fiction, but author Jonathan Coe's new novel, The Proof of My Innocence, might have you rethink that particular attitude. Jonathan is best known for novels including What a Carve-Up, which took on the Thatcher years with gusto, and Middle England, which had Brexit as its backdrop. It went on to win the Costa Book Award. The Proof of My Innocence is Jonathan's 15th novel. It's set during Liz Truss's spell as British Prime Minister,
all 49 days of it. It's a story of a political blogger on the trail of a secretive and sinister think tank founded at Cambridge in the 1980s. It's told in three parts. One, a kind of cosy crime. The second, a memoir of Cambridge in the 1980s. And the third, a piece of autofiction from two Gen Zs. Delighted to have Jonathan Coe join us on the programme this evening. I'm wondering to what extent that 49 days was even a starting point or an inspiration in this novel, or did it come along later on, Jonathan?
It came along later on, actually. I knew that the opening situation of the novel was going to be a young woman having graduated from university and coming back to live with her parents, being a bit glum and depressed about it, you know, that whole kind of failure to launch syndrome. So that presupposed a setting of kind of autumn 2022, really, I thought. And then when I just looked at the news websites to see what was going on around about then, and I thought, yes, it was Liz Truss, of course. And my last novel, Bourneville, had a very long time frame. It was a 75-year story. And with this one, I just wanted to contract and to do something concise. So Liz Truss's appointment and resignation gave me the perfect bookend.
It's an awful lot easier to have something over 49 days than 75 years, I would have thought. Yeah. you mentioned then that Phil is the young woman in question who comes back home from university and, you know, has done reasonably well in university for herself. But here she finds herself working, you know, in an awful job in the airport, way below the education that she's found herself. I think your own daughters might be in and around that, or would have been in and around that type of situation in their lives, or age in their lives at any rate, in 2022. Is this something that you've noticed about the Gen Z generation, that they found themselves in this failure to launch, as you put it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how specific it is to that generation. I mean, I seem to remember that when I left university as an undergraduate all the way back in 1983, you know, I think this is the assumption that the university is the culmination of a long logical process of education. And at the end of that, you know exactly where you're going. Actually, you know, many people leave university not having a clue what they want to do with their lives. Luckily, I knew that I wanted to be a writer, so I had that kind of mission driving me on. Otherwise, there's a good chance you'll find yourself back with your parents and no idea what you want to do. What I do think about that generation is that there's a notable anxiety about the legacy they've been left in terms of climate and in terms of political direction by the generations ahead of them. So I do think they're facing quite a tough future at the moment, and my heart goes out to them.
Was it very different in the 1980s when you finished up in university, even though you had that, you say you had that idea, yes, I want to be a writer? I can't imagine that you sat down at the desk, started writing, and immediately your books were published and all was fine.
No, it took me a long time to get published, absolutely. But the circumstances were much more conducive to what I had to do, which was basically to sit around at my desk writing books. I came down to London after I'd done my PhD at Warwick. I found myself a room in a council flat with some medical students, and I was paying £8 a week as opposed to, you know, £1,500 a month or whatever they have to pay these days. I signed on, got supplementary benefits, 30 quid a week, I think it was, which I lived on, you know, not like a king in London in 1986, but I lived on it. And I don't think those kind of safety nets are available to young people these days. It's much tougher out there.
Are we talking Thatcher's Britain when you describe what you've just described to me? Maybe it wasn't that bad at all, was it?
Well, I am. And one of the things people forget about Thatcher's Britain, and which I talk about in the book, it didn't all kick off on, you know, May the 2nd, 1979 or whenever it was. It took a long time for the changes that she wrought to kind of filter through. And yeah, you know, you could feel the cold wind of Thatcherism in the air in the 1980s, but it was still an easier country to live in, I think, for many of us back then.
Kind of nostalgia involved there, which I think is a very important theme within the story that you're telling. But let's talk about these three, essentially, almost it's like three separate genres that you give to us across The Proof of My Innocence, starting out with, I'm calling it a cosy crime. We find Phil and a friend of the family's, an older man, he's the guy, the blogger, who's on the hunt of this 1980s Cambridge group, and what are they at now? We find them up in this lovely little hotel in the Cotswolds, and this is like, you know, it really is Sunday afternoon television type of thing. One person gets killed, gets murdered, and everybody could have done it.
Well, I'm a great reader of crime fiction, particularly Golden Age crime, so your Agatha Christie's and your Dorothy Sayers and those kinds of things. And cozy crime, so-called, seems to be the kind of modern iteration of that, where the tweeness, the quaintness, and often the Englishness of the setting is really, you know, turned up to, dialed up to 11. So I just thought it would be fun to not make fun of that exactly, but just write something like that, because a lot of these books are self-parodic anyway. You know, you've got a whole series with which are narrated by cat detectives and dog detectives now and this kind of thing. So nothing I can do can really top what's going on already. But for the second part of the book, which is a big flashback to Cambridge in the 1980s, I realised I needed a different style. And, you know, it's 40 years since I was at Cambridge now, and I've never written about that time in my life before. And there's another genre which has become quite popular in the last few years called dark academia, which is stories of slightly sinister secret societies and cultish groups of students, charismatic dons erting a kind of guru-like influence over people. And that seemed just right, really, for the story I was going to tell.
Yeah, and that very much is part of that second part. But before we move on to it, let me ask you a little bit about Detective Prudence Freeborn and the fun you had with her. Prudent is not what she is in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, I had a male detective when I first started writing the book. He was Swiss for complicated reasons. So I was writing a kind of Swiss Maigret character. And it wasn't really coming off the page. It wasn't really grabbing me. So I just thought, well, who out of the people I know do I see as a kind of charismatic detective? I thought immediately of a friend of mine who I've portrayed very faithfully, I think, in the character of Prudence Freeborn. She has a great appetite for life, great energy, a little bit eccentric. And yeah, I thought this kind of Dickensian figure dressed all in black with the shock of white hair would make a good cozy crime detective, really. And I think it worked.
And is your pal happy with the portrayal of her?
So far, yeah.
She hasn't. That middle section of the book that you've described, Jonathan, this dark academia, I do wonder if there's any other kind, really, that would be of interest to the writer. But it suggests to me that, in fact, and I don't think it's that far off, I think you've said this, many of the experiences are similar to experiences you would have had yourself at college.
Yeah, I mean, as the section goes on, it becomes slightly more outlandish, and you know, you get a secret society with weird occult drawings sketched out on the floor of their meeting room and that kind of thing. I didn't encounter any of that. But the first half of the book, which is really a kind of catalogue of social embarrassments, those are very much drawn from my experience, because coming from a grammar school in Birmingham, I thought I was pretty posh until I got to Cambridge and realised that the Etonians and the Harrovians wouldn't give me the time of day, basically. So it was a steep learning curve in the social hierarchy of young Britain.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a character in the book who gets a lot of stick because he's from Middlesbrough, I presume. And it's not quite you, because there's a writer as well in the mix. So you're probably a mix. You're a gathering of all of them. But the suggestion here, I wondered if this was part of your intention, that perhaps the rise of the right, if I put it, or the rise of more extreme right-wing policies that we seem to be seeing both in Britain and internationally at the moment, that the seeds of that may in fact be back in the 1980s.
Yeah, that is what the book is kind of arguing, really, that it's only mentioned kind of obliquely in passing. You know, I've always seen the miners' strike as a kind of watershed in British politics and the real point where hardcore Thatcherism won its first big victory and really started to kick in. And of course, on the other side of the Atlantic, you had the Reagan presidency, much more hardline conservatism than America had really seen up until that point. And the two kind of fertilized each other and fed off each other. And you still see that going on now with the, you know, British politicians who turn up at CPAC and these other conservative conferences in America and so on. And, you know, and now we have the Trump presidency again, term two. So, I don't know what to make of that or how many of his slightly frightening promises he's going to make good on in the next 4 years. Dismantling the system of government, really, which seems to be his aim.
Will the presence of a Labour government, albeit a new Labour government, maybe a little bit more towards the centre than towards the left, will the presence of that in Britain make it very different from the Reagan-Thatcher era?
Well, who knows what kind of relationship Keir Starmer and David Lammy are going to have with President Trump. It's got off to quite a rocky start with the digging up of their old tweets and this kind of thing. I just feel in Britain at the moment, we've been granted a little kind of breathing space because the drift towards the right seems to be gathering momentum in America, in France, in Italy, in Germany, definitely. And the British people rather unexpectedly have sort of pulled back from that and opted for a kind of soft social democracy. So that's all to the good, I think, for the next 4 or 5 years. But is it just a breathing space or is it a new direction? Well, that's what we've got to wait and see.
You hand the final part of The Proof of My Innocence, the novel that we're speaking about, Jonathan Coe, you hand that over to two young Gen Zers, as I say, for a piece of autofiction, a bit like The Cozy Crime. Now, I know you're very clear that you didn't want to make fun of Cozy Crime in that opening section. What about autofiction in the final section? Did you want to have a little critique of that particular genre?
Well, what I wanted to do really was kind of speak up for traditional fiction, if you like. I mean, there is a feeling among not just writers of autofiction, but more widespread than that, I think, that making up stories, making up characters, putting invented words into their mouths is a bit kind of juvenile, really. And I kind of strongly push back against this. And the older I get and the more I write, the more I love the contrivances of fiction, actually. The more I love plot, the more I love grotesquerie in characterization, the more I love structure, coincidence, all of these things, which are the kind of antithesis of the autofiction aesthetic. And I think you can create something truthful out of all of that. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book. And that's what Phil and Rash, the two Gen Zers, are arguing about, really, as the book goes on. And right at the end of the book, when the moment comes for the murderer to be arrested, Phil has to say, well, look, I've been telling this story from my own point of view, in my own voice all this time, but I wasn't there when this happened. So we're just going to have to use our imaginations. And, you know, ultimately, the imagination is what you do have to use.
Jonathan Coe speaking to us about his new novel, The Proof of My Innocence, which is published by Viking. The role of the artist is to make the invisible visible, so says Brian Maguire. For 5 decades, he has used his art as activism, an act of solidarity with causes and injustices he observed both here at home in Ireland and around the world. An exhibition covering 2 decades of Brian Maguire's work has opened at the Hugh Lane Gallery. La Grande Illusion encompasses the themes that have preoccupied him over the years, ranging from the struggle for justice for the victims of the Stardust tragedy to the mass destruction of the slums of Nairobi, from the plight of migrants fleeing war-torn countries to the destruction of the rainforests of the Amazon. Jess Fahey has been to see the exhibition for us and she's with me in studio this evening. As I say, we really are looking at big events and big ideas both nationally and internationally. What do you think is the drive behind the work in La Grande Illusion, Jess?
So I think throughout his career, he's been politically motivated and it comes from, such a source of care and kindness and humanity that he seems to be drawn to these stories. Often actually not even just the big events, but actually sometimes smaller, more hidden stories to really show us, I suppose, the tragedy of the world and of life and what's going on. And I think in this particular one of the things they drew together as a sort of central theme is how much this is the result of differences and inequalities in class and the haves and the have-nots. And that's something that we too often kind of turn a blind eye to. So as an artist, he's drawing our attention to it.
And in fact, that political side to his order, that political side to the man himself was there from the very beginning, right back in his days in NCAD.
Yeah, so he was born in Bray, 1951, and went to Dunleary Technical College, that's now IADT. But when he was in NCAD, he said themselves as students were forever protesting, but they were also right next to the Dáil. So they forever were looking out as well at protests. And he mentioned back then that the army would have been sent in to defuse these, you know, peaceful protests. And then from that time onwards, he was involved in different political parties, ultimately the Labour Party, even designing, I think, one of the poster campaigns for the marriage equality as well. So he's definitely an activist at home as well as drawing attention to stories abroad.
Let's speak specifically to one of the events at home here in Ireland, which was very important to him. And I think kind of gives us a kind of a watershed moment in his career as well. I'm going to tweet some images as we go along here at RTE Arena if you want to look at them as Jess is speaking about them. Stardust Memorial, give us the context for this first of all. Obviously it's a reference back to the awful fire in 1981, wasn't it? Yeah, mm-hmm. on Valentine's Night at the Stardust Disco.
Yeah, so it's one of the things that he does so well that you see represented here, which is take something that could be forgotten. And by making a painting of it, you make sure that there's a longevity to that story. And in this case, that was so particularly important because the original ruling was a suspicion of arson, which meant then that the owners were not liable. And over a long period of time, it's only this year, I think, that they've finally deemed the deaths unlawful deaths. Yeah. So a painting kind of holds that in the public consciousness. And the way he paints makes it all the more visceral and real and emotive because he paints in this, what we call sort of a gestural style, which would be very loose brushwork. And in doing that, it creates a sort of emotional intensity.
And how would you describe this image? I mean, that there is an absolutely haunting quality to mm-hmm. it, no question about that. This kind of white wall type of set of figures in the foreground.
Yeah, potentially white coffins.
Yeah.
And most of the people who died or were badly injured were young people because this was a disco. And they seem to be almost stood up in front like a kind of haunting army. And then in the background, we see presumably the club, certainly lights behind windows and buildings, and then multiple colours flowing and sort of swirling in between, which, you know, when you know of the story, you're sort of brought to think about those kind of disco lights. And then when you know the tragedy of the story, you start to think about those lights, that fire, that context.
Yeah, yeah, there's an orange, trapped. A little orange section up towards the top yeah. end of the painting, which kindly has this suggestion of fire about it.
Mm-hmm.
No question about that at all. I mentioned, Jess, that this particular painting and this and remembering the Stardust period does define a watershed moment in his career. This exhibition only deals with works from 2007 through until the present day.
Yeah, he said himself about his work that, you know, in the late 1990s, his main subject started to become more about death. Prior to that, it had been more about the sort of isolation of the artist in Ireland and things like that. But from late 90s onwards, so I think this is one of those works that really represents him hitting that particular stride of that way of using a kind of slightly abstracted form to create these emotional works that record tragedies and difficulties and injustices.
But he started subsequent to this particular that painting and to the works in and around the Stardust, he started to work on a more international on events and injustices that he was seeing on a more international basis.
Yeah.
How does he go about choosing those, and how does he address the fact that he is, you know, a white Irish man telling other people's stories?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it is something that we're so conscious about today. And I think there's a couple of things going on. One, if you see him interviewed, he's an extraordinarily warm person and kind person. Mm. And any of those sort of worries about it being sort of exploitative work for someone else's energy and fame doesn't come across at all. And more importantly, perhaps, is that he's often invited. I think most of the time he is. So there's a sort of ethical code that he has to be invited into these areas. And often the artists or people who want to draw attention to the difficulties that they're experiencing can't do it in their own country because they could be in trouble.
Like fear for their own safety.
Well, there's stories even in Ireland, you know, of Kathleen Fox painted Countess Markovitch, you know, at Stephen's Green, and she had to send it off to America for 40 years because she'd painted it there and then. And you couldn't have that in the country. So he almost is the, maybe you could kind of see him as the sort of stand-in or surrogate in a way to get those artworks out there.
Let's tweet another work called Nairobi Slum Clearance. This is from 2007, from the very beginning years of the exhibition. What is he dealing with here?
So again, this is one of the things that he does is go and experience some of the difficult situations that people are faced around the world. In this case here in Nairobi, particularly interesting from a kind of post-colonial perspective because the city was set up in the 19th century as a kind of important port point for British colonial powers. Mm. But when they were building the city, they kept the Europeans up on the highlands and in the sort of more fertile areas. And the natives, the African people, were put into these lower grounds that are flooding every year, that are, you know, really bad ground and territories. And it has stayed pretty much like that. But he takes a particular moment when, you know, the government is coming in to try and improve the situation. But really what they're doing is destroying the little that these people have. So they're wiping it away, and this is called slum clearance.
And again, we have a very strong orange foreground in this, and then a white background up at the top of the painting, white sections, which presumably are the huts being...
They look like corrugated iron or aluminium.
There is a kind of an abstraction in all of this.
From a distance, you wouldn't be able to tell what this is. And I think there is still that, you know, aesthetic quality to his work. They are still beautiful, even if the subjects are difficult and dark. But the sort of attack, I suppose, in a way, of his brushwork gives across that emotional content, and also perhaps in this case even represents that wiping away or sweeping away.
I want to climate change is a big and very important issue in his work. I want to tweet a painting now called Burning Amazon. Again, a sense in this painting, Jess, if you describe it to us, there's a darkness, there's black soot, there's fire in the background. But again, quite abstract version of this.
Yeah, so when you first look at it, you might think it's a sort of abstract expressionist work, you know, something where it isn't about representing figurative or an image at all. But the more you look at it, the more you start to see that actually the reason it's blurred here is because of smoke and because of fire. And you start to make out these skeletal remains of the trees within the Amazon. Even the choice of colours are sort of sickening and hard, and almost like tar-like in the way he applies the black. He spent a lot of time in the Amazon and met the different people and sort of integrated himself into families who'd been, you know, really devastated by this, you know, ruination of.
And in his 2023 exhibition in the Carolyn Gallery was called The Clock Winds Down, and fans of Christy Moore will recognise that song title.
And they are friends. In fact, at the opening of this exhibition in the Hugh Lane, Christy Moore was the one to open it with his usual, you know, extraordinary ability to talk and just hit it just right. And even the Stardust as well, you know, Christy Moore's song on the same subject was also banned. So they seem to have good correlation, you know, between similar ideas and programs and projects.
In fact, you were making the comparison. A lot of people would know and understand Christy Moore's activism through his songs. You would say that, in fact, Brian Maguire, if you want to understand him, think of him in a visual Christy Moore.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good way of kind of thinking about it and looking at his work. So it's not so, you know, alien or difficult to go in and explore it.
I'm not going to tweet this particular image because we were speaking a little bit about it before we came to air. This is a piece which includes a Nature Morte or Nature Morte. I don't know whether it's a Spanish version of that particular phrase. And it's of a decapitated person. Quite shocking. And you were saying, Jess, that don't think this is all abstracted work. There are some very visceral and very figurative images in this exhibition.
Yeah, and, you know, again, sort of upsetting because you don't necessarily expect to be confronted with that, but it is so important in the way that he tells these stories. And even in terms of some of the ones where it is just a singular head, you know, in art, we're used to, you know, say a painter just painting the head and not giving you the rest of the body, just as an artistic choice. But in that instance, there isn't a rest of a body. That's all there was. And he usually works from photographs, even though he goes to the places and witnesses things firsthand. And I suppose in a way then it's filtered a couple of times, you know, through him, his practice, but originally the image may be coming from a photograph. And he meets the families, he knows the people, so he has this, you know, really true, warm connection with the people and then tries to tell their stories. And you can't tell their stories in a sanitized way. You know, you can't, you know, gloss over it. If that's the reality, you need to, you know, really show that, you know.
I'll tweet one final image. Bentiu International Displacement Camp. And this is, in some ways, self-explanatory. Yeah. It's a displacement camp, and he has visited several of these types of situations mm-hmm. and painted them.
This is in the South Sudan. You know, at the sort of first or one of the earlier parts of their civil war, which is in some ways still continuing. In the case of this, though, again, if you don't know the subject and you're just looking at it from just a purely aesthetic point of view, it is a beautiful work.
Yeah, and the beautiful use of kind the of colours, whites and greys.
Absolutely. And then the little kind of hints of the sort of orange yellow kind of colours throughout. There's also a wonderful little red dot, which seems to be a little figure as well, which, you know, famously artists like Turner used, you know, to draw the eye in and get attention. But again, it is still social commentary.
And an important exhibition.
Oh, yes, most definitely. Definitely is.
Important to see it, but mm-hmm. be warned that there are some very upsetting and graphic images within it. Brian Maguire, Jess Fahey has been speaking to us about Brian Maguire, La Grande Illusion. It's at the Huillain Gallery and it runs through right through until March the 23rd of 2025. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Ali Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Pauline McNamara. Speak to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.